There is a disturbing trend among teens and some young adults that is really, really hard to understand. And it's also hard to treat. And it's hard to talk about. It's self-harm. Now, for most of us, pain is something to avoid. But for a growing number of teenagers, cutting is a misguided way to cope with stress. And Dr. Janice Whitlock is the director of the Cornell Research Program on Self-Injury and Recovery. She helps families to understand this scary trend and what to do to help. And she is co-author of a book called Healing Self-Injury, A Compassionate Guide for Parents and Other Loved Ones. And Dr. Janice Whitlock joins us now. Hi there.
Hi, thank you.
For people like me who are new to this topic, the obvious and first question is why? Why would anyone intentionally hurt themselves?
That is a great question, and you are right that it is almost pretty much always the first question that people ask. But I maybe before that, I should can I tell you a little bit about what self-harm is?
Yeah.
Because I think a lot of people, when they tend to, when they see somebody, for example, someone who's cutting, they tend to think of suicide or a suicidal gesture. Mm-hmm. And most of the research that I do is on something that we call here in the States non-suicidal self-injury. So kids who cut or people who cut in order to feel better rather than to try to end life. And it's defined as the deliberate destruction of body tissue for purposes that are not socially sanctioned and without suicidal intent.
Mm-hmm.
So the not socially sanctioned is there because we recognize that there are certain kinds of behaviors that are undertaken for aesthetic purposes, like tattooing or piercing, for example. And there can be some self-injury function in that when there's a lot of tattooing and piercing, but in general, we don't include that as part of self-injury. And last thing I'll say before I answer your question for real, is that there is a relationship between non-suicidal self-injury and suicide or suicidal thoughts and gestures, but it's there. We recognize them as distinct. And the reason we recognize them as distinct, and this goes to your question, is that it's pretty clear that that non-suicidal self-injury is undertaken from a psychologically understandable and I would argue even healthy desire to feel better. It's not about, it's usually not even necessarily about punishing oneself, although that can be there. It's most often comes from a desire to feel reintegrated or calm. And for a variety of neurological, physiological, and sort of agent symbolic reasons, it works. It can work for some people very quickly.
Because if you're feeling generalized, non-specific anxiety, emotional pain, worry, there's not much concrete you can do about that, right?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, that's the subject of lots of conversation and certainly lots of therapy sessions.
Yeah.
I mean, there are things people can do, and people ultimately, in order to stop using self-injury as a mechanism, as a tool for feeling better, people do have to learn other ways. And there are strategies. The thing is that most of those strategies that someone would learn to downregulate is what we call basically to feel better if you're feeling anxious or depressed, involve time and a greater degree of patience and skill than someone who self-injures has discovered they have to have in order to make things feel better very quickly.
Mm.
So, it's a quick and easy route to feeling calmer quickly for the people that it works for.
How common is it?
Oh, super common, actually. It's interesting. There's not even a lot of global differences in terms of the rates that we see. So there's more and more studies now across the world, and most of those studies find prevalence rates to be, so if we're talking about young people, so adolescents and young adults, we'd say probably 20 to 25% of that population has ever self-injured. So that includes a single time. If you're talking about, you know, the number of people who have used self-injury or are using self-injury fairly regularly, it would be a little bit lower. So probably in the 15 to 20% range. And if you're talking about, you know, how many people, for example, in a school are currently walking around using self-injury to make themselves feel better, it's probably about 10%.
Mm. Did you see the show Sharp Objects?
Yeah, I did.
Was it useful or not useful?
Way
of understanding
it.
Very,
I think
very
it's,
hard to watch, yeah.
I think there was a lot in there that made it useful. It's been a little while actually since I've watched it, so I have to try to pull back and remember exactly if they how they represented it. But within the context of her life, and certainly the idea that, she had an abuse history, a trauma history, it self-injury is really common among that subpopulation because the trauma tends to really amplify emotion. And when someone runs up against things that can trigger strong emotion, then, some people discover that self-injury is a quick and easy route to just calming down, which is something you saw there.
So, and here's a conversation I had with my producer. I said I would love to talk about self-harm on the radio and help people to understand it and maybe how to treat it. But is there a chance that we will do damage by talking about it? That we're in the school drop-off zone or pick-up zone at the moment. Does talking about self-harm increase the incidence of it in the same way we sometimes think about suicide?
Yeah, it's a great question, and the answer is sort of pretty much categorically no, with the exception of, I wouldn't go into a school right now and talk about lots of different forms and like show a lot of pictures and that kind of thing. That would be potentially super triggering for. I primarily it isn't so much that I would worry that somebody who's never self-injured or never considered it would suddenly decide they want to. I mean, it's really not a very, oh, it's not a very sexy looking thing. But somebody who has either self-injured or has proclivities that way might get triggered, and I would worry about them. So I wouldn't worry that it was going to cause it in people who really just don't have much of a proclivity for it. And the other thing is, I mean, we thought a lot about this early on when self-injury was starting to first be studied in earnest, probably like early part of the millennium, around 2000, somewhere between 2003 and 2006 and 7 is when things were really getting going. And there was a lot of conversation about how news and outlets like you guys should be covering this.
Yeah.
And it became pretty clear pretty quickly that was the people who really didn't know much about it were the adults. The young people, for the most part, had already encountered it in some way, either in friends, sometimes siblings, or certainly media. So I'd say at this point, I wouldn't worry about that part. We
Well,
just don't want to go in
yeah.
a lot of detail.
Related question, I would be sure that my 8-year-old and 6-year-old had never thought about this. So, I mean, we'll talk about sort of treatment and things you can do to get ahead of it. But while we're on the topic, should I be sitting them down at some point and saying, here's this thing that happens? Because I would be worried about putting ideas in their head, but I would want to get to them before the wrong sort of peer group got to them.
Yes, that is a great question, and this is advice for schools too, who sort of grapple with this larger issue. The general advice is don't you don't need to be very specific. Like, you don't need to sit your kids down or start an assembly talking about self-injury. A really good way to kind of touch on it, but to contextualize it, is to talk about the ways, sort of the current ways that young people seem to be dealing with stress. So I would have multiple messages. Like, one is it's a stressful time to be on the planet, categorically. True everywhere we live. It's just hard. That means that there's more and more people that are showing what we think of as stress-related behaviors and symptoms. And sometimes there's no behavior that goes along with it. Sometimes it's just feelings, like they feel anxious a lot or depressed, or just ways that make them feel uncomfortable more often than they would like, or that it feels normal to them. And that there are certain kinds of things that people sometimes do in to try to make themselves feel better. And then you could say, self-injury, there's this thing called self-harm that's one of them, but there's also drug use and doing risky things, using tobacco or other, basically chemicals, sex, other, there's lots of things that people do. So you could have this larger conversation about things people do to show that they're stressed out or distressed.
Good
And
advice.
then Yeah, and then you can say, and so here's how do you learn how to recognize that in yourself and in your friends? And then what do? If you notice that in yourself or in someone else. And that's where the messaging around, find an adult you trust to confide in, and hopefully that adult will be able to help them access services and supports.
I'm speaking with Dr. Janice Whitlock, who is an expert on self-harm. Her book is called Healing Self-Injury, A Compassionate Guide for Parents and Other Loved Ones. Is self-harm contagious, Janice?
Well, all indications are yes, it can be. It's not like the measles or something, or somebody's around you, or the flu. They're definitely going to pick it up. But it does tend to be like other emotions and behaviors. It does tend to kind of spread in certain kinds of cases. So it's not uncommon, for example, to see self-injury spread through school systems if you've got multiple vulnerable kinds of kids there. If there's a high status young person who's using self-injury and there are peers around them that are aware of that and kind of want to fit in with that person or with that group, we definitely see it happen. So that's something that school administrators and other youth-serving professionals need to be aware of.
We spoke to Dr. Jean Twenge recently about the connection between smartphones and a rise in teen mental health problems. Do you see a connection between self-harm and smartphones?
You know, this is something I get asked a lot, and I also do a lot of work on social media and mental health, and it's a tricky question. It's a hard question to answer. So in short, the studies that have set out to empirically look at this are somewhat suggestive, like some of her work, which I'm sure she talked about. But there's also a number of studies and now meta-analyses, which basically look at a whole bunch of studies together, showing that there's a modest relationship or a very sometimes small relationship. It's not huge. But I would assert that it's, you know, access to the internet through lots of different ways is so ubiquitous and it's so a part of everyday life at this point that it's really hard to empirically study this. And it's complicated by the fact that there's so many other huge stressors going on at the moment that are fairly global and large and persistent. Like, how do you separate out young people and older people awareness of the challenges posed by climate change, for example, and the kinds of anxieties that can provoke from the constant stimulation of going, you know, being online and being inundated with people, content, just, you know, stuff going on all the time and the fracturing that can kind of cause us all to feel. So it's, you know, we get out of the zone of being able to say with scientific certainty anything. So I'm just going to say, I'm going to go out a little bit on a limb here and say, I think that probably it's one piece of a bigger puzzle of why we seem to be seeing pretty significant increases in the mental health burden of young people, but not just young people. It's pretty much, everybody, but they're like our canaries in the coal mine in my mind. When we start to really see it in them the way we're seeing it now, we really need to pay attention. And I do suspect that access to devices and all of the stuff that comes with that is probably not making things better.
Yeah, I was just talking to my wife about this morning before chatting to you, and the topic of connectedness comes up. And she said to me that she has a theory that teenagers feel connected when they're online with their friends and yet are missing genuine connectedness. And I know connectedness is one of the things that you recommend as a way to guard against falling into self-harm.
Yeah, it's such a good... It's like, I think of it as the paradox of over-connectedness and under-connectedness.
Yeah.
It's like being able to go online and interact with so many different people or your very best friends, you know, but constantly can simultaneously help somebody feel reassured that they're not alone in the world, but also be overwhelming. It's too much in some cases. And I think one of the things that might be happening, and again, this is sort of conjecture on my part, is that even though most of the smartphones and devices that young people have are primarily used to connect with existing friends and then existing networks that they have mostly probably in real life. And in that way, they're not a lot different than the kinds of connections that, you know, I would have had as a girl before any of this was available. But the difference is that it's so constant. Like, all of the things that used to matter in the world, that used to be, let me see how I say this, all the things that used to just be assumed to be structurally a part of socializing us,
Yeah.
like walls. Like when I went to my bedroom at night, I didn't have a phone in my room. So unless I snuck down the hall and used the phone, which I did sometimes, mostly I didn't, I was in my room with a book, music, and a journal and homework. Right? I didn't have all my friends in there, and I didn't have to have the self-discipline to turn off the phone or to put it away at some time. So I had lots of opportunity to just kind of be with myself, to be bored, to not be chronically connected. And I didn't, it didn't occur to me to worry that my friends weren't there, even though we were spending, from after school maybe till up the next morning without talking. I think most young people don't have that experience these days. So there's this, like, it's really paradoxical. There's healthy connection potentially in there, and it really helps be able to just reach out to a friend right away and get support. But there's also, it's in some ways, it's sort of choking off experiences about just being either just with oneself or being bored, which is actually a useful thing.
Yeah. So I have two more questions. One is about creating good conditions to avoid someone starting to self-harm, and the other is what to do if you see signs that they're doing it. So first of all, you talked about the perfect conditions for this, all the pieces of the puzzle that make this thrive as a problem in our society. So what can parents do to help their kids enter the teenage years and not have self-harm, something they end up doing?
I think that the challenge of the current age is to help young people and ourselves be more self-aware than was ever required before. So the things that they can do is to help them understand that the emotions that they're going to have are really normal, that they're going to be exposed to a lot of different possible ways of dealing with emotions, and a lot of those are probably not so healthy. To open up and keep open as much as possible lines of communication so that their child can confide in them when things are starting to get confusing. So to do kind of what I said earlier about helping them to notice inside themselves and other people, what's the difference between sort of normal stress and concerning stress? And then helping them know that when they start to feel that thing, it's really okay and important to reach out to somebody that you trust, even if it's not you. If there's, I think one of the best things adults can do, parents can do, is to surround or at least have a one, if not a few other more adults in their children's life that they trust, that they know their child might turn to if they don't feel totally comfortable turning to them right away, depending on what's going up.
Okay, and then what about if you find out that your child is self-injuring? What to do?
Okay. First words of wisdom is don't panic. It's really easy to feel shock and then fear and then sometimes really quickly anger. Totally normal. It's okay. I wouldn't censure a parent for that, but I would strongly urge them if they feel like there's really negative feelings coming up to try to keep as much of a poker face as possible, take a little space, kind of integrate it. And then the dominant message they want to give to their child, if they found out, is I love you, we're here for you, we'll figure this out together. It's not too much for me. I can understand it. And I'm glad I know, and I'm glad that I can support you. And then I would get professional help if you really feel like you're not sure what to do or where to go.
Is it addictive behavior?
That's a good question. It can become, it doesn't satisfy conditions that could be called addiction in clinical terms, but it definitely can become habitual enough that people tend to rely on it, and it tends to become the go-to thing for some people. It tends to be really episodic, something people should know. It can come and go. So somebody can use it, every day or every few days or once a week for some period of time. It can be days, weeks, or months. And then it can sort of stop or drift away for a long period of time. Days, weeks, or months, or years, and then show back up again. It isn't like alcohol or something or cigarettes, where someone starts and then they find that they really like it, and then they're compelled to do it regularly. this isn't like that. But it can become just this quick and easy go-to. And that way it can be really hard for people to stop if it's their thing.
What is the healthy substitute for self-harm?
It depends on the person. I mean,
Yeah.
there is not a healthy substitute. And so that's one of the reasons why if somebody's, been injuring for a while and it's something that they have a hard time walking away from, it really does help to get therapeutic support because the therapist will help them figure out what might be the best strategies for them in terms of being able to back down and start using other kinds of coping strategies. But basically anything, the best advice I've heard from multiple people who injure as they're starting to stop injuring is give yourself, if you can, the impulse to injure after a triggering event, and a triggering event is often interpersonal, like feelings of rejection, for example, or feelings of failure. So give yourself, if you feel that urge to injure, if you can wait like 15 minutes, then usually the urge will start to drift away a bit. And for that 15 minutes, it's a really good idea not to just sit in whatever room you are and ruminate, but like leave the room, leave, if you can go outside and go for a walk, if you can just do something different and healthy for that period of time, then it gets easier and easier to bypass
Gee, that sounds
the
like
injury.
great advice for any sort of addictive behavior.
Exactly. It's very similar. Yeah. And then ultimately, people who self-injure is another thing to say is people who self-injure, I assume most of them are fairly tactile. So whatever it is that they're going to use, that they're going to substitute or start to use instead, for at least some of them, I would imagine that some sort of tactile, physically sensory experience is probably going to be the most satisfying, at least for a bit. So it can be, being physical, like being athletic or doing yoga, or even just, stroking one's arm or something where there's some physical sensation in some of the same ways that it might feel to injure, but not painful and not in a way that's going to damage the body. Those are some things that, you might try at the beginning.
It's a whole separate topic, but connectedness, physicality, distraction, exercise, it sounds like you're describing team sports.
It for the, for some people that's great. I will say though, for some people, especially if it's super intense sports, it's not great because that with the pressure to perform, it can actually be a trigger for some people who self-injure. So you really that's why I think it requires a higher than average degree of self-awareness, and it is very useful to have someone who can either knows you super well and can help you come up with different solutions to try, or a therapist who can kind of help you figure it out. Because one person's like, I gotta do this to feel better, it makes me feel like sports really helps me, could be another person's trigger. So you gotta be
Okay.
a little careful, but yeah.
Complicated. Thank you so much for helping us understand this. Janice, you speak really well, and I could chat to you all day. Dr. Janice Whitlock, author of Healing Self-Injury, A Compassionate Guide for Parents and Other Loved Ones. Thanks for your time.
You're very welcome. Thank you so much.